All right, Mike, we're on.
Pierre, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How about you?
I'm very well. I think we got another interesting guest coming up today. This is kind of fun.
For sure, for sure. Alfonso Pecatiello. He's, you know, I mean, I think on, at least on this show, it's been a while. I mean, it's been years, I think, since we've actually spoken to him. But it wasn't for a lack of his notes and his commentary over the last couple of years. You know, it's been interesting to say the least, right? I mean, you know, we've had such a big shift in policy, macroeconomic policy in the last year. And that's caused, that's caused a host of sort of knock-on effects that are really concerning, right?
I don't think it's just this administration too. I mean, this is decades of debt build.
Yeah.
Great financial crisis, COVID, building massive amounts of a debt into the system, layering on top of what was already a pretty levered system. And, you know, the implications of that and what that means for the bond market, and then the follow-on effects to, you know, what that means for policy, you know, the various central
right.
banks and fiscal policies derived around the world have limitations based on those bond market vigilantes to some degree. And so you've got some really interesting dynamics that traditionally held may no longer apply. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you're in an environment where you have a tremendous amount of debt, you've got some inflation pressures, you've got some potential growth issues, then you just sprinkle on a little bit of an oil shock, some geopolitical conflict, war, and AI, and wow, you know, what are the implications of all that from the perspective of how does the system actually work anymore? So, you know, we've seen recently cuts on the short end, and then the long end resulting in higher rates. And that's
yeah,
not something that's happened for 40 years. And so the dynamics and the connective tissue between the asset classes and the structural dynamics of growth and inflation, they change. And this is the macro regime shift, you know, people talk about. And you're seeing that. You're seeing things like scarce assets like gold and silver start to behave more like those safe assets, and bonds not necessarily performing the typical non-correlated price flow that they've seen, you know, in that 1982 to 2022 market where interest rates were persistently, you know, down. And inflation pressure
right.
persistently down. And so I think there's this tendency for folks or investment professionals to live in the past and live on those past relationships. And so I'm very interested to dig in with Alfonso on how those dynamics are changing the sort of the correlation of asset classes. And then how does that trickle down to the portfolio consequences, and then how, as an investment professional, as an investment advisor, a CIO and an allocator, how you should start thinking through your asset mix in order to account for what is potentially a very different regime than we've had over the last 40 years.
Yeah. This is where I really love what Alfonso does, because he's got such a great way of explaining things. And he's got, like, if I look back on, you know, if we look back on the last, I mean, at least just even over the period since we last spoke to him on Raise Your Average, I, you know, it's uncanny how right he was. And, you know, the way that he goes about using charts to describe not only the current situation, but how the lags affect, you know, the situation 12, 18 months down the road. And, So looking back at those points of conversation that we had with him in the past, and you can go and revisit those episodes with Alfonso, because then you'll see, you know, where what we talked about with him, you know, a couple of years ago, and how that's panned out. So that's what I'm really looking for. I'm looking forward to seeing like where we are today in his view, and what all these moving parts mean and how they actually translate into the portfolio. It's going to be an interesting chat. I'm sure he's got a lot of enlightening new insights and charts.
Yeah, and I agree with you. He's got a really good grasp of the interconnected dynamics of all of the items you laid out, and sometimes it's not intuitive, and that's the other thing, the intuition.
That's it. That's what it is, right? It's not
years.
Yeah. But I like your point.
The intuition
your point
built
is
over the last 40 years is maybe incongruent with the next 5 or 10.
Flawed, and you see it in the narratives that are coming out from Wall Street, from all across sort of the financial ecosystem. Which is disagreement between different parties and different folks in different aspects of the market, whether it's the bond market or the equity market. I tend to side with the folks in the bond market because they tend to have a more it is intuitive because of the compounded knowledge that folks in the bond market have about how debt dynamics affect all markets. And really, the bond market is at the center of all the activity that we end up seeing either in the bond market or in capital markets at large, but also in equity markets because of the way debt works its way into the whole mechanism. But it's so Alfonso is one of those First of all, I love what amazes me always with Europeans and with Alfonso being Italian is, first of all, how his command of the English language, but not only his command of the English language, but his command of the narrative. It's astonishing how good he is at relating things. So I think our audience will find it easy, obviously, to relate to what he's saying. Having been a very significant player at ING in the past and managing $20 billion in bond assets, Alfonso has an especially acute grasp of how everything he does in the bond market or has done in the bond market trickles its way into all markets.
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is where it starts, right? You start with the risk-free rate of a treasury bill, and then you build onto that some duration risk, which incorporates inflation expectations and growth expectations, and the expectations around geopolitical risk and the potential for those debts to be paid back in, whether they're debased or not. Those are the basis for everything else, right? You start with a treasury bill, risk-free, then you move into some duration risk. And then you have the equity risk premia that's built on top of that, which is, obviously very heavily impacted by the bond market. So I don't think it's contentious to say the bond market is kind of where things really quite start. And that's where liquidity flows from. And then you've got the global liquidity flows that across nation states to buy assets and how that impacts dollar flows, things like that, and interest rates. So it's, another interesting topic to think through.
Yeah. And so much, but if you anybody watching, financial media, sure, they talk about the bond market, but they spend so much time on the equity market. There's so much in the financial business and the investment business, of course, because equities are the growth engine of the portfolio, the traditional growth engine of the portfolio. So much of the conversation is dominated by what's happening in equity markets, but underneath it all is the bond market. That's the part that always I almost wish, you know, there was more focus at times on what's happening in the bond market, you know, how strong or how fragile is the bond market? And that's a question we're going to touch on today is the, you know, what's happening in the bond market and why, you know, and are investors paying attention to that? And I think the answer is no, because there's so much focus on the equity market that, you know, when things go sideways in the bond market, it's only then that conversation takes place.
Yeah.
And the big question is, you know, why does it matter? Right.
Well, yeah, no, I totally agree. So helping, advisors and allocators kind of dig into that. Like at the same time, the cross currents of Fed independence, fiscal dominance, monetary policy, a new Fed chair, you know, Warsh is a little bit more balance sheet hawkish, not necessarily interest rate hawkish, but that has right. implications as well that are interesting and maybe not well thought through. And I come back to this. There's this lived experience and the way it has been. And I hear, you know, very sophisticated investors and allocators talking about, you know, the relationship between stocks and bonds as though it's like the last 40 years where you had, you know, just broadly inflation reduction and falling interest rates. And, you know, in those environments where you have disinflationary growth largely as the predominant regime, stocks and bonds are non-correlated. But in an area, in a time where you have lots of debt, you have inflation implications, you have fiscal dominance entering the picture, you have Fed independence in question. What are those relationships like in that regime versus the regime we're in today? And I think that's the one thing I just see a lot of people living in the past almost, in their assumptions, which is, you know, if this is hard, like this is one of the behavioral issues with, investors, you know, your lived experience can over inform your current allocations to some degree. You have to think about, what the implications are for where we are currently for the next 5 and 10 years. And I think that's where
it's hard.
Fonzo was trying to like
the strange thing is that, you know, it's not strange. I mean, it's behavioral. It's a very big behavioral problem. I think it's hard to let go of that lived experience, especially when you consider the alternative is possibly far more uncomfortable.
Agreed. This is what diversification is about, though. It's the explicit recognition that you don't know the future. And when you diversify, what you're doing is saying, well, I'm not 100% sure of the regime I'm in. And so I'm going to hold a portfolio of assets that perform a little differently from one another based on their structural relationship to those dynamics of growth and inflation.
Yeah. Hard to let go of the winners of the past. But if you want to keep what like you've got,
It's like what you say, there's, you know, I don't think it's any secret that software is dominating the US and, you know, investors are very comfortable in that area, notwithstanding the recent, you know, sort of 30% decline in the software indexes. But where's the puck going, right? So I got to think through my portfolio today and I have to think through where we are now and what the implications of those of that situational awareness is. And then you've got to look at your portfolio and say, am I positioned where I need to be? And then on top of that, the advisor or allocator has to take into account the behavioral bias of the individual that they're speaking to and what their tracking error ability is. How much can they tolerate a deviation from the tracking portfolio? And not the negative track, not the positive tracking error, the negative tracking error. You know, when you're hauling your diversification and it's kind of taking away, but you do understand that the future is unknowable. So you've got to diversify because you've got to be prepared for the unknown.
I mean, you got to ask yourself.
It's always a tough conversation.
Absolutely. The big question is, you know, the sort of big bottom line question that comes to my mind is, you know, what side do you want to be on? Do you want to be the advisor who is proactively making these, you know, these allocations, these changes to, your portfolio and your clients' portfolios? Or do you want to be reactive?
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Very well. How are you?
Not too bad. Mike, great to see you. Nice to see you. Always nice to see you, my friend. And we're just arguing about the challenges with people still putting pineapple on their pizza. Yes, I would like to cover that. We're going to cover two topics today. We're going to cover global macro and pizza toppings. Okay, and I think we should.
What is wrong?
I'm on pizza toppings.
I like Hawaiian pizza.
God, stop it.
I like pineapple on pizza.
I think the podcast is done already, guys.
That's it.
Oh, boy. Alpha, we got another one.
Well, before we begin, I just wanted to cap off something that we were just talking about, Mike, which was that I don't think it's any mistake. You know, the way that you just broached the subject of how would you build a portfolio if you absolutely didn't know what was coming next. And I think what I wanted to just cap that off with to say was that if that's the that is a mental model and a framework for how to have that conversation with clients.
Yeah.
Because in fact, if you had a portfolio built around the idea that you absolutely have no clue about what's coming next in markets, in markets overall, you would own all those assets that you don't currently own.
Look, I think, I'm a big fan of talking about portfolio construction.
Yeah.
I have this 8 quadrant model whose idea is exactly that, is to be relatively agnostic about what happens and to think about what are the macro forces that you want your portfolio to be somehow prepared for. There's a lot of complexities because some things are easy to have. They're positive carry. They are positive drift. So you can have them. It's pretty easy. Some other things are pretty bad to have all the time, right? So there is a cost that you have to carry for owning convexity, for stagflation, for example. But we can, I'm very, very happy to cover this topic. Very happy to cover a more fascinating topic for people such as, what is going on now? What's the terms of trade shock and the Strait of Hormuz and all of that? Sure, I can talk about that too. We can go whatever direction you want. Like,
I think where we were starting though, Alf, it was just the idea of, because you came in a little bit midstream on that one. I was just saying, you know, if someone's thinking about their portfolio today, let's start from, I don't really know anything. I don't have any macro tilts. What would I own? Because I want that as the base portfolio. Because I don't know anything, I'm going to prioritize diversification.
Sure.
And I think if we go through your 8 quadrant model, that sets us up to start to talk through, hey, here's the base.
Yeah.
Here's your tilts. Like you have some opinions. Now you've done two things. One is you've got a base portfolio. You can measure if your tilts are actually working. That's one thing. And I was saying, it's not just about returns. It's about returns. It's about the risk taken to earn those returns. And it's about the investor journey. Right. You also have to consider the tracking error challenges that the end investor, advisor, or allocator has to face in order to make it through the labyrinth and the gauntlet that is diversification. So you've got this behavioral tilt that you have to factor in. Then it's okay, now you've got your macro view you want to impart. And then let's dig into what's happening to today and how you might think through those dynamics that are occurring today to impart some of the vectors that you're seeing that might be underrepresented or are clear risks to the classic 60-40. Does that make sense to roll through it in that way?
If you want to talk about that, I think the whole hour will go like that. I'm super happy to do this because this is how I run my own savings portfolio.
Yeah.
So forget about my macro hedge fund. That's supposed to be actually... I allocate to my fund as well, but it takes a certain portion of the risk that I want to cover with the discretionary global macro positive skew.
might as well be covered by CTAs, you know, as thinking behind that part of risk. But the rest is built around building a portfolio for. So I can just talk about how I have built a portfolio for my savings, which is all that you just discussed, starting from the pure, let's call it macro risk parity portfolio that tries to cover equal risk weight, all the possible scenarios you can imagine. And then from there, you have to think, you know, about where do you want to overweight a certain tilt? What about the drift? What about the negative carry? What about the risk allocation? What about leverage? What about the path dependence? It's a very, very fascinating discussion. So very happy to just do that for the whole 50 minutes we have left.
Wonderful. Well, I think we don't. Yeah. Well, let's leave 10 or 15 minutes for what's going on today, because I think that would be very helpful too. So
sure. Let's do that.
Let's try to do a little bit of both. Let's do a little bit of both, because I do think it's very valuable to have this discussion to set the table. But I think it's also very important today to think through some of the global macro implications that you're seeing and the dynamics and relationships they have with inflation growth and the asset classes.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So, for our audiences,
we're already going. I'd like some of this will be in the thing.
So, if you don't know Alfonso, or joined today by Alfonso Pecatiello, founder of macro hedge fund Palinuro Capital, and we've already talked about what we're going to unpack today. So, why don't we get going?
Ciao, guys. Very nice to be here, as always.
Great to have you.
Big fan. So, what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I think we've got, there's a lot happening under the hood of global markets. So I think we should talk about the next phase of the cycle and how that could look very different from the last 40 years. As sort of the big starting opening question, Alfonso, is that, you know, most investors think of treasuries as the safest asset in the world. But listening to your work lately, it sounds like you think the bond market itself may be the most fragile part of the system right now. What are investors missing?
So from a credit perspective, treasuries are the safest thing on earth. That's correct. The government of the United States issues the very currency that is underlying the treasury market. So there is no problem in getting paid back in that currency. Obviously, there is a discussion between the nominal dollars you get paid back or the real dollars you get paid back. That's a very different story. But credit-wise, they are the safest thing on earth. What I refer to in my work is mostly about the fragility of the bond market as the base of the pyramid that underlies all the risk spectrum that sits above that. So there is credit, there is equities, there is a pyramid of risk, basically, that grows on top of the repo market and the fixed income market. And lately, there has been a bit of fragility shown there in the form of basis trades or swap spreads. The more, let's say, repo-funded type of trades that many banks and many hedge funds have in their portfolio to try and take advantage of some regulatory dislocations there. These hedge funds especially have become a big liquidity provider in the bond market over the last 10 years. And the reason is that regulation has crippled the ability of commercial banks and investment banks to actually warehouse risk on their balance sheet. So we have created a system where the government of the United States issues a lot of treasuries every year. That's to fund continuously large deficits. And the buyers of treasuries are, of course, still abundant around the world. We still use the dollar as the denominator of pretty much everything. If you run a hedge fund, you will have to have dollar collateral, which probably means T-bills, which, you know, again, means you are supporting that system. But the imbalance is growing. The supply of collateral is very large and the demand of collateral is still there. But the marginal buyer tends to be these days hedge funds. Hedge funds tend to play a very important role. And that's very nice. But the problem is that hedge funds are very mark-to-market driven as an investor, which means any volatility in those type of trades which are very leveraged will lead to a cascade of stop losses, which will lead to a tightening of swap spreads or basis trading much more unstable, which leads to the bond market to be more fragile, which means the base of the pyramid, the very stability of the entire market is, I would say, more often put under strain than before.
So is the bond market the next source of systemic market risk?
Look, the regulators and the policymakers have a lot of tools to intervene. Yeah. But it's, as we were discussing with Mike before, it's a journey experience, or is the path to get there can be quite rocky. I mean, if you have some unwind in some of these trades, there is a lot of volatility that happens before the regulators and the policymakers want to dampen that volatility. So look, the bond market, also as an asset class, used to be something where you had for 10 to 20 years a fantastic portfolio property in owning bonds. You were owning an asset with a positive carry and roll. So for people not very familiar with this ivory tower bond market language, it means that if you bought a 10-year or a 30-year bond, the yield was above the risk-free rate, namely the carry was positive, and then the bond, a 30-year bond, would roll down to be a 29-year bond in a year from now, and the slope of the curve would basically allow you to roll positively on that slope of the curve. So that basically means you were paid to own the asset class and wait. And effectively, you had an amazing diversification property because the only risk that you had to face as an investor basically was recession, deflationary type of environments, broad risk off type of environment in the beta assets, in equities. And so bonds would work amazing in these environments to cover the risks. You never ever had to worry about an inflationary shock. You never ever had to worry about the large use of fiscal deficits. None of this was a shock that was part of your radar even. And so bonds were just amazing. And we moved from that type of environment to an environment where systemically, the demand-supply imbalance in the bond market is growing in the wrong direction, as we've just discussed. And also, the inflationary shocks are becoming more evident over time. And therefore, if you look at 100 years of data and you would look at the correlation between bonds and stocks, you will realize that the negative correlation property only exists when core inflation is predictably below 3%. So the 2% inflation target that central bank has, the market tends to give them a bit of the benefit of the doubt. They say, you know, if it's 3%, we'll say it's close to 2. It's open. Like, we'll have a zero correlation between bonds and stocks. But as soon as you go above 3%, in any forecast horizon, bonds have never worked as a diversifier, and correctly so. It does make sense. And so we are in a world where in the US, core inflation has been above target and close to 3% for 5 years in a row. And it's obvious that bonds don't work as well anymore, I would say, as the sole portfolio diversifier. But we have seen that there is a myriad of other portfolio diversifiers you can add, and you should have had all the time in your portfolio.
So is the 60-40 portfolio built for a world that no longer exists?
Do you allow swearing on this podcast?
Swearing?
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
The 60-40 portfolio is a piece of shit. Because that's my swearing. Yeah, sorry for the French. Why am I being so opinionated here? It's not a portfolio. In the 60-40 portfolio, 85% of the risk comes from the 60 part. I mean, what portfolio is that? You might as well just be long stocks. And by the way, long stocks, what does it mean? You are long a market cap weighted index, which is the S&P 500. In the luckiest part, it would be long MSCI World, which again is 65% US. So again, it's another market cap weighted index. So you are long US tech, and you're long a lot of momentum, by the way, because being a market cap weighted index, the bigger companies will become bigger. So you're long a lot of momentum on the upside. You're very geographically concentrated, and you have literally no hedge. None.
Yeah.
Because the 40 part is completely irrelevant in risk weighting terms. So the 60-40 portfolio is not only dead, but it's a piece of shit in the first place.
So that's a resounding yes.
Yes, very, very resounding. So now I'm only criticizing.
I think it's...
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to say the 60-40 portfolio reminds me of the QWERTY keyboard, right? The QWERTY keyboard was, you know, because we didn't want to get the typewriter stuck and jammed.
Yet we still use this QWERTY keyboard today because we've all gotten used to it. And I think the 60/40 portfolio, if you look from 1982 to 2022, in that period where you had, you know, disinflationary growth predominantly for 40 years, rates going down for 40 years, as you point out, this free ride on bond diversification. And that is a tough habit to break. You even see it from commentators today, very, very, very smart global macro commentaries, and they keep slipping into the old paradigm rather than the paradigm we're currently in. And while it worked for a period of time, that period of time that the 60/40 worked, the regime was quite favorable to the portfolio. And so we've got this recency bias, I'll call it. It's a 40-year recency bias that has sort of infiltrated most institutional portfolios. And it's hard thing to break.
Yeah.
But we've seen 5 years of gold adding tremendous value and being a diversifier and underrepresented in portfolios. Go back to you guys.
And I was just going to just add the cross current of opinions on this is causing a lot of confusion. And I think when that confusion sets in, it's even more likely that investors or advisors would hang on to the bias, because if they can't sort through the confusion themselves, it's much easier to just maintain the status quo.
Yeah. That's absolutely correct. So maybe we should try to do something to propose an alternative rather than only criticizing 60/40, which is one of my preferred.
Absolutely.
By the way, so very happy to do that. maybe we should talk about how to build a portfolio. I can openly say that what I'm about to describe is the framework I have found the most useful for myself and for my savings in general over time. Doesn't mean this is the holy grail. It means it's a framework, so people can, you know, take it home and see if it makes sense for them. So the first thing I would like to say is that in order to deploy this framework, you need to be comfortable with the idea of leverage being a good thing, not a bad thing, being a good thing. And the only reason why this is true is in order for you to be able to properly diversify your portfolio for many different macro environments, you are going to need a gross exposure in your portfolio that sums up to more than 100. And the reason why that is the case is that many diversifying items I'm going to mention do not have that embedded volatility that is able to compete with the volatility of equities on the downside. So if you have an equity drawdown, like there has been many, many more times, of 20, 30, 40%, an equity will represent a large portion of the risk you take. They should represent a large portion of the risk you take in any portfolio. In order to diversify that component away, you are going to need a lot of good returns coming from other assets, or you're going to need leverage to make sure that these smaller returns are still diversifying enough once leverage is taken into account, okay? So leverage can amplify your protection in the portfolio. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's actually a good thing if used properly. Now,
if I can add, the leverage is about adding non-correlated streams of return. This isn't more cowbell. This isn't triple levered S&P, right? This is bringing leverage from asset classes that have structurally different driving forces behind them. Thus, they perform in different ways in your portfolio, and the leverage is there to give them the returns that match those of equity. You don't want the maniacs running the asylum. And in a 60, you've already talked about the 60/40 context.
Yeah. And additionally, Mike, the other thing you can think about this is, I mean, you have been pioneers of this, is to use leverage to obtain the same amount of equity risk using way less capital than you need, so that you're freeing up the capital to go and diversify your portfolio without using the leverage on the diversification side. That's another way to think about it. So if you want to say, look, I like trend following or macro hedge funds as diversifiers, yes, then the ability for you to buy a leveraged macro hedge fund, it only means you have to allocate to some manager that runs 50 vol. Okay, then all of a sudden you're going to be leveraged, but there is no leveraged product on the hedge fund or the CTA industry by itself, which means the other way to do it is you're going to free up more cash from your standard allocations by the use of leverage. Namely, you're going to buy futures rather than buying the ETFs that are underlying them, and the cash you save can be therefore used to diversify your portfolio more effectively. Again, using leverage as a defensive tool, not an offensive tool, to reduce risk in the portfolio. Okay, that was introduction number one. So if you're a person that cannot use leverage, then these days there are companies that are doing a fantastic job, not to do publicity, but yeah, I think you guys have had some very nice ideas over time to enable people to do this. If you can't use leverage altogether, there are solutions today that don't include it. Like, you can use some of these products that are offered, return stacking programs, for example, or also you can use leveraged ETF. Now, leveraged ETF is a big discussion because there is a volatility drag and there are some, you know, rebalancing, timing and other things in there. But let's assume for a second you guys can and are willing to use leverage as a diversifying part of your portfolio, okay? Diversifying enabler of your portfolio, okay? What are the basics that you want to cover? The first basic is that you want to make money over time. And ideally, you want to make enough return in nominal terms to cover inflation compounding over time and potentially to be able to accrue some return on top of inflation, okay? So your policy objective, I think, shouldn't be I will become rich out of this, but it should be I will preserve my purchasing power, plus ideally I will be able to add, maybe depending on your vol target, maybe like 3 to 4% on top of the inflation over time, compounding. That will do fantastic work over the next 10 to 20 years for your wealth protection and accumulation. Okay, so that's your objective. In order to achieve that, you must have assets that have a positive drift in your portfolio. So what it means is that if you look at the distribution of these assets, they tend to grow relatively predictably. So the median return every year is positive, okay? Median return is positive. What assets do you have there? Well, you have stocks. And why do stocks have a median positive return over time? It's because the world grows. It doesn't fall apart. So as the world grows, earnings grow, and earnings by themselves will add positive drift to an equity portfolio and therefore to your portfolio. The second asset is bonds. Bonds also pay you a positive drift if above the risk-free rate, of course. So you need a positively sloping curve, otherwise you're not achieving this objective. So we start again from stocks and bonds, said the guy who said that 60-40 is a piece of shit. But the starting point is a bit different. Here already I need to add two caveats. Bonds and stocks only have a positive drift if you buy them at the correct valuation. So you cannot blindly just add all the risks, but we're going to talk about the tilts maybe later on. Okay, let's assume that bonds and stocks have positive drift at any price, which is untrue, but they will be part of your portfolio, bonds and stocks. Now, against this very nice positive drifting portfolio, what is that you need to protect? What are the environments in which the median return is not going to work in your favor? Okay, so there is one environment, which is an inflationary shock. Then there is another environment, which is a, let's call it, global deleveraging shock. That's another environment where this portfolio isn't going to work for you. Let's stay with this for a moment, okay? So how do you protect against these environments? Inflationary environment. Okay, so to do this, you need historically a blend of assets, because inflationary environments are different every time. So sometimes, like in the 70s, you will have gold, and gold will probably cover most of your problem in that case. Sometimes, like in 2022, you will have gold, and gold will not work in that environment. It will not do fantastic, so that wouldn't work. What is that it did great in 2022? Well, that's programs that are designed to be able to capitalize on macroeconomic trends. So that's CTAs, a trend type of program, or global macro hedge funds that have a positive skew. Those two tend to be good instruments where managers have designed a strategy that does capitalize exactly on this type of environment. So this basket should in principle contain, if you're very sophisticated, inflation swaps. If you're not, because you will trade inflation straight away, directly, it's the source of the problem, right? This has a lot of complexity, so let's park it for a second and let's go back to the more tradable stuff. Gold, commodities in general, and CTA and global macro hedge funds. This should be part of your inflationary absorption shock. Okay. And then there is the other shock. And the other shock is a global deleveraging. It can be a deflationary problem, but it can also be a credit problem. So it can be an emerging market problem, a credit systemic problem. So the world, which is built on fiat creation and expansion through credit and fiscal deficits, ends up collapsing on itself. So credit freezes, we don't have access to credit, fiscal deficits shrink. It's basically a compression, a deleveraging problem. You can think of what we have just seen with oil price as an exogenous shock, as one of the variants that this deleveraging can take. When the input of energy grows aggressively, all of a sudden the availability of credit, the ability to lever up the balance sheets collapses on themselves. Correlations rapidly converge, so bonds don't work, equities don't work, even gold didn't work recently. So then what are you left with? The dollar. The US dollar is a fantastic diversifier in that case, but simply because we denominate all the assets in dollars. So as you compress the system, as you deleverage the system, effectively you're bidding up the denominator, which for all the crap we throw at the dollar these days, it's still the dollar. It is still the dollar. The dollar is the main denominator of all asset classes. So here we're trying to cover the base, okay? Stocks and bonds. With bonds, you're already hedging the disinflationary type of shock. Fine. That's relatively easy and straightforward to understand. Stocks, bonds, program to protect against inflation, program to protect against a deleveraging, which will be an embedded long dollar position that you carry in your portfolio. With this book, you have relatively, let's say, covered all the potential angles. Once this job is done, through the use of leverage, you have space to go and add uncorrelated source of returns, which means you can add a new unit of return and a new unit of risk that do not correlate with much that you have in your portfolio, which is a fantastic property to have, because if you look at how portfolio volatility is mathematically calculated, the more uncorrelated assets you can add, and the non-correlation doesn't need to be zero. It can be 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, as long as the expected return of these new uncorrelated strategies is, let's say, at least half the vol it generates. If there is no correlation, then it's a fantastic thing to add to your portfolio. What can you add there? The choices are relatively broad, and it depends from your understanding of what non-correlated means. Do you think that if you get no mark from an AV provider, you're uncorrelated? Namely, I'm trying to mock now private equity and private credit. Do you think you are uncorrelated? Yeah, if you think so, then you can add as much private credit and private equity you want, because you don't receive an AV mark, and so you can't know if you're correlated or not. Do you want more transparent programs? Okay. Then you can look at, things like art, or you can look at things like hedge funds, or you can think about how to look for uncorrelated assets. The final aim should be that the core of your portfolio is relatively protected against many of the different problems you can face. It still preserves a positive drift over time, because that's the most important thing. It still preserves a positive drift over time. And the uncorrelated assets can add to this positive drift while not being related to the same source of risk as your core 4 or 5 asset classes allocation in the main portfolio. These are the principles that I think people should try and maybe consider when building a portfolio.
And I think one of the key parts there, Alfonso, is the idea that if you add these non-correlated returns, even using leverage to do so, if you have, a return of 8%, volatility of 15%, and you have a non-correlated asset that also has that construct, the 200% portfolio doesn't double the returns in the vol.
No.
Because of the non-correlation, right? You actually get a portfolio that has leverage, but actually may have less vol than the portfolio you started with no leverage.
Absolutely, yes.
And that's the magic, right? That's the magic, is that as you pointed out so succinctly, it's leverage as a diversification enhancer, where you're not getting just more cowbell, right? Yeah. You're actually getting, you might have absolutely the same risk in the portfolio, or lower risk rather, and the same return by doing some of these techniques.
So there are some nuances to consider in all this discussion, because it sounds relatively straightforward on paper. The implementation is much harder. the constraints are several. So the first constraint is how much negative drag are you willing to accept on your portfolio for owning some of these diversifiers? So the holy grail is to own a diversifier that protects against a specific scenario or more while carrying positive or while having a flat or positive drift, okay? That is relatively hard to obtain. So one example is gold. What is the expected return of gold? Extremely hard to quantify by any model because how do you calculate expected returns? Yeah, okay. In bonds, you can look at the return. Again, you can look at carry and roll, right? You can say, okay, if the curve slope stays relatively constant over time, I bought it at this yield, the risk-free rate is this. I can kind of calculate what the expected return of a bond should be within certain ranges. What's the expected return of equities? Yeah, you know what the earnings growth right. should roughly be. You know the valuations. You can, again, kind of a long time horizon, very long time horizons, have an idea about what your expected return is out of that investment. How do you do the same for gold? Gold doesn't have cash flows. So you can say gold is a competitor to fiat money, and therefore you can try to extrapolate what will be the pace of new fiat money creation around the world. That's one way I use to try and extrapolate what the return will be. But again, it's very, very hard to predict what the pace of global money creation will be next year alone, let alone in 5 years. So, and what is the carry of gold by itself? It's an instrument. Gold carries very heavily negative because the alternative, in order for you to buy gold, is to take off your dollar risk-free cash, today yielding 3.5%, and to go and buy an asset that has implicitly zero carry. So your opportunity cost to own gold is negative 3.5 until proven wrong, basically, when right now it's an asset that is drifting on the upside. So the 3.5% negative carry over a year doesn't really matter. But ex ante, you cannot take for granted that gold will keep going up. So there is an opportunity cost to own gold, right? As there has been an opportunity cost to own CTA programs in your portfolio, trend programs, for a very long time. It's an asset class that basically absolutely went nowhere, if not lost money for almost a decade before coming in and actually delivering the property that we all wanted to deliver. So you need to think about this. Eh? When you size something up, you need to think about what is the negative drag that I'm able and willing to take. Because the neighbor tracking error, I think, is one of the biggest, behavioral issues that there are in portfolio construction.
Yeah.
If you have had a book in 2021 or in 2025, that was a balanced book where you had negatively dragging assets and you built it in a way that 85% of your risk is not equities, but the equities maybe account for 40% of your risk or 50% of your risk, then you are guaranteed on an absolute return basis to have largely underperformed your neighbor. You are guaranteed. It's a fact. There is no discussion. It's mathematics. You simply have less, like half of the equity risk that is running. How do you think you want to compete with that? I mean, it's not going to work. In a year where equities are up 30%, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the same goes if you had, by the way, an internationally diversified equity portfolio, rather than having MSCI World or the S&P 500 as your equity portfolio. For between 2013 and 2019, you looked like an idiot owning European banks and emerging markets. I mean, you looked like a complete fool. And over the last 3-4 years, you look like a hero. So again, it's all about your objectives. If you have
value too, right?
Value, yeah. I mean, European banks, emerging markets, a clear example of value tilt. So if your tracking error will be measured on your neighbor, I would say your starting point is pretty bad in building the portfolio we just discussed. If you're able instead to benchmark the success of the portfolio on absolute or real returns over time versus the units of vol that your portfolio is staking, I think this is perhaps a better approach than 60-40 or any other very heavily concentrated types of investments.
Yeah. Let me just add to that, because I think it's a key and critical point that often gets overlooked in the, you know, sort of the economic man who only makes economic decisions all the time and has the perfectly diversified portfolio, which no one has. The idea of tracking error is very important, because that's the thing that gets people to give up on the diversifiers. And they only give up on the diversifiers when they're in drawdown, thereby locking in those losses and not providing the opportunity for returns. So it's something that has to be considered by the allocator or the advisor. I have this perfectly beautiful, optimized, diversified portfolio that's going to give me real returns, 3 or 4% above inflation, and I'm going to get those for the long term. But I do have to consider the constraint that when the equity markets are up 30% and I'm up 12%, where can my advisor, where can my client, where can my asset owner sit on that? Do they need to be kind of closer to 18 or 19? Meaning that I'm going to have to build in some of the assets that are their tracking error to the point they can tolerate the diversification opportunities that I'm building in. And that's a, that is a dynamic that has to be considered. And one of the most important dynamics that the advisor slash CIO allocator is in charge of. He's got to make sure the board's going to be comfortable with the tracking error, the end client's going to be comfortable with the tracking error and not give up. So that, just want to add that point and back over to you.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. So having your objectives very clear and not moving the yardstick over time, by the way, on your objectives is probably the best behavioral decision you can have while building a portfolio. I would like to, because of what I said, I think the least controversial thing is to have an inflation protection in your portfolio. I think that's relatively well understood by now. At least by now, it's relatively well understood. 5 years ago, maybe not so. How you achieve that, I think it's also relatively well understood. It's CTAs, it's macro, it's commodities in general. Gold, of course, plays a big portion of that. But what about your deleveraging component? Mm-hmm. I think that's very important. The dollar is a super interesting topic to discuss in all of this, because look, if you're based in the US, how do you get dollar exposure? It's very interesting, right? Because if you're buying if you're buying US stocks, you're not getting any dollar exposure. Mm-hmm. You're denominated in dollars. So, but if you are a Canadian pension fund and you're buying US stocks, well, then all of a sudden you're also exposed to the dollar. And by the way, they're very well aware of that. There is something which is the FX hedge ratio, which was never discussed, and now it's been discussed ad nauseam over the last 2 years because of the correlation between the dollar and risk, right? So the dollar had this bond-like property effectively for a very long time, where if you had the risk of inequities, the dollar will rally. And so if you were a European pension fund or a Canadian pension fund and you bought US stocks, which you did in very large size, then all of a sudden, if you had a drawdown, then the dollar would cushion your drawdown. And I'm not done, because being long the dollar and short Canadian dollar and short the euro was actually a positive carry trade. I'm basically discussing bonds all over again, positive carry, diversification properties. So portfolios had a very large exposure to the dollar because it was very convenient to do so, until this thesis was damaged heavily by the Trump administration take, basically, on geopolitics and tariffs. And so everybody started saying, oh, it was evident the dollar doesn't work anymore as a hedge. Equities are down and the dollar is down, which was compounding the problem for these Canadian pension funds or European investors. And we rushed to try and hedge some of this dollar exposure, right? So people basically took off some of their dollar exposure, they hedged it. And then you have a deleveraging event. Then you have an exogenous shock, which is oil prices go from $60 to $100. And everybody thinks, again, oh, now I need to de-risk. I need to compress my exposure. We have one of these deleveraging environments. And guess what is the only asset class that actually makes money? It's the dollar. So having a net long dollar exposure in your portfolio is still ex-ante, by the way the global system is built, is still ex-ante a diversifying thing you can have in your portfolio. Is it always a diversifying aspect? No. Are bonds always diversifying? No. Is the dollar always diversifying? No. Is the dollar protecting specifically one corner of your portfolio? Yes, it is. Can you find me something else that protects only that? Very, very hard. Very, very hard. So the dollar, which still, by the way, remains positive carry against many expressions. I mean, can be Canada, can be Europe, can be Korea, can be Japan. The dollar is still positive carry against all of these. Like bonds, by the way, have been now re-rated in terms of carry and roll because of this term premium we are pricing. The curves are steeper. So bonds have now regained some of that advantage in terms of the static reward you get. The dollar, you still get a static reward by being long the dollar, which is the carry. Do they protect certain parts of your portfolio? Yes, they do. So I would always advise that if people are looking to build a portfolio around these themes, do not be dogmatic. Dollar bonds are not good or bad. The dollar is not good or bad. They are tools in your portfolio that you should try to have at every point in time. How much should you have?
Mm-hmm. That's a really important distinction. I just want to sort of harp on that a little bit, because I think people do spend way too much time talking about good versus bad, good or bad, as opposed to being more objective about it, more agnostic about it.
I think you're right. I mean, we're talking about concepts to build a portfolio that is more robust. Mm-hmm. So there shouldn't be any dogmatic assumption of what's good and what's bad. So now, how much should you own of all of this? Well, if your objective is to generate inflation plus 4 over time on average as your median return, then you need to have a decent allocation to positively drifting assets. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to achieve that. It's pretty simple mathematics. So about, depending from your age and your risk tolerance, but anything from 35 to 60% of your risk should perhaps be still equity-linked risk, okay, in the portfolio. Let's say as a median yardstick, let's say 50% of your risk should be in equities. Note, in the 60-40 portfolio, that's 85. So now I said it's 50. That's much lower risk, much lower risk contribution to your portfolio. Then you will have your diversifiers all sized in a specific way. So you will have your inflation sizing, your bond sizing, your dollar sizing. Let's say that you do equal weight sizing, all of these. So all of them will equal weight, I mean equal vol weighted contribution. So you're going to look at the volatility of each asset class, and you're going to use leverage appropriately or not use leverage if the asset class is very volatile, to bring all these diversifiers to potentially the same vol contribution. It's as if you're building a defense in a football team, and a defense team, and you want 4 of your defenders to be all of them the same level. You don't want your right fullback to be terrible and your left back to be fantastic. You want all of them to be ready to defend at the same skill level. Okay. If you have done this and you have used leverage, then you will be able to also free up some cash to do diversifying strategies. And that's maybe for a different discussion one other day. But when you look at this portfolio, and for my savings portfolio, I do something similar to this. The drawdowns that you face in this portfolio are incredibly smaller than the drawdown you face in a 60-40 portfolio. So 60-40 has gone down routinely 30 to 40% in proper financial crisis. And a portfolio like this would have gone down something like maybe 9 to 10% in the worst case scenario. It's a way that I think it would be fantastic if one day this could be democratized as a way of investing a savings portfolio, because I think it's the bill for the median household trying to compound wealth and protect against drawdown in a much better way than other portfolios that are heavily commercialized these days do. And also the path dependency, something that Mike is very, very familiar with and very fond of talking about. The path dependency on this portfolio is way smaller. When people talk about the 4% rule and they talk about how much can I withdraw from a certain portfolio, that is effectively a path dependency exercise. If you started to save in a 60-40 portfolio in 1999 and you put all your wealth in there to start with and you wanted to do a 4% rule, effectively you were broke by 2005, 2006, because you had a massive drawdown in 2000, 2001. Then you had to take 4% out of that portfolio every year while not recovering from the drawdown. Mm-hmm. You're basically broke. You had to go back to the labor market 7 years later. And that's not what you want if you're a retiree that is counting on a 4% rule. What if instead your drawdown is likely to be maximum in the 10, 15% area? Well, then your path dependence is much, much, much safer to predict there. So I think this type of approach is much better fitting to the average household. It's a bit harder and to sell, and it's a bit less flashy, I would say, than talking about easy concepts and also to conditioned people to get off what they used to do very successfully for 40 years, because there was pretty much one macro regime prevalent for 85 or 90% of the time over the last 30 years. And that's until 2020, of course. And nevertheless, we've had 6 years of clear empirical evidence that a proper stable portfolio is not the 60-40, and yet, there's still a lot of educational job to do, I think, and dissemination and publications and discussions like this that you know, people should try to have when thinking about their portfolio.
Eloquent. Agreed wholeheartedly. Diversification is kind of always having to say you're sorry, as Brian Portnoy says. And that has certainly been the case in, you know, prior to 2020. And then the other thing we've talked about diversification is, again, explicit recognition that you don't know the future. And so, you know, these are the concepts to build a really solid foundation. I wonder if we might take the last 10 minutes, though, and now start to talk about the current situation, your global macro hedge fund that you're managing now, where you're seeing risks, how you're positioning.
Yeah.
And, you know, CTAs and the global macro side, I think, are incredibly important diversification strategies because they offer some structural differences. One is that they trade assets across all global equity markets, all global bond markets, commodity markets, and currency markets. So you have these four broad areas where you can be long or short. And so when you think about the inflation implications that Alfonso's talked about, okay, so you build that into the portfolio. Well, that's your commodities. That's your currencies as well, because you can be short the US dollar or long the US dollar. There's some equity markets respond much better to inflationary impulses, like Canada or Peru. And so you're building all of these things in to provide the inflation side. On the stagflation or the deleveraging side, you have the ability to be short, not only long US dollars, but you can be short assets. And so through these often sort of more mechanical or systematic strategies, not always, some of them are just more discretionary, but they provide those broad diversification opportunities, the ability to hedge inflation, the ability to hedge the deleveraging as a wonderful component to build into the portfolio we just talked about. So maybe let me volley that back over to you, Alfonso, and let's dig into the current positioning, what you're seeing in today's world, and what you see as the potential outcomes as we move forward in the last 10 minutes.
So we have had an exogenous supply shock. Effectively, we have taken off a large part of the global oil supply. Estimates are anywhere between 15 and 25%. It's a very large disruptions, the supply of energy, not only oil, but also LNG, natural gas, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem with this type of shock is that it often brings correlations to one across asset classes. So we've had evidence of that over the last few days, where basically whether you were long bonds or long equities or long credit or long, even long gold, frankly, it just didn't work. So everything drew down at the same time. Even the idiosyncrasies of trading a certain interest rate market versus another one are thrown out of the window, because the only driver of everything which is going on is the price of oil. And not only the price of oil, but the perceived distribution of the price of oil, which is closely linked to the length of the de facto closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Because this is not a linear process, it's a convex process. So in the beginning, there are things that we can do in the Western world to try and limit the impact. So you see today, for example, that G7 is discussing a concerted release of barrels of oil from the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, of many countries at the same time. So mechanically, you will be able to offset some of this physical supply shortage if you release your stockpile and your inventory. But then there are problems on the other side of the distribution, which is the longer you go, let's say another few weeks, actually, you're going to have production shutdowns in larger production shutdowns in Middle East producers, because their storage tanks are getting full. There is no other place where they can store the production. So they'll have to stop it. And once they stop it, to restart it again, it takes months. So you have these very convex problems here, where the process is linear. So it gets slightly worse every day until it gets much worse if the war effectively lasts for more than a few weeks. So this is a problem where I think a reasonable active investor that is taking discretionary views here should not try to take a lot of risk on the portfolio. And the reason is that unless you have an edge on predicting the variable behind all of this, which is the length of the de facto closure of the Strait of Hormuz, I don't have an edge. I doubt that many people out there have an edge in predicting this. You are basically gambling on a very nonlinear event, right? I mean, how it works is if you have a risk on view, every day that the Strait of Hormuz is de facto closed, this gets worse, okay? So you are long risk. So you're long an asset that has a positive drift, but time works against you. The longer you stay close, the worse it is. On the other hand, if you're a guy betting on the end of the world, then you're probably buying negative carry assets. So, you know, blow up type of things like equity puts and other things like this. And you are doing this, but there is a potential resolution down the road, which is going to completely kill your view very rapidly. You're going to have a rapid drawdown whenever there is a proper resolution here. And this is the nature of what we're looking at. And there is, I think, no way to intelligently take risks here unless you think you have an edge in predicting this distribution of risks around the Strait of Hormuz closure. Otherwise, I'm sorry to break it to many people, but you're gambling. You're literally gambling, which is, I think, another type of discussion. There's nothing terrible about gambling either, but it's not part of the investment discussion we want to have. So,
to your point, Alfonso, look at the flip-flopping in the market the last couple of days, right? I mean, you know, it's on again, it's off again. You know, the war is going to be over quickly. We don't know when the war is going to be over. It's going to be over in a few weeks. It's going to be over in a few, you know, it's just, and every time there's a pronouncement, an announcement from the White House, the market reverses. You know, it changes course. It's either super negative or super positive, but there's no in between.
Absolutely, yes. So
yeah,
we can talk about what the implications would be of a prolonged de facto closure of the Strait of Hormuz, but the conversation might be stale in 2 days, whenever. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit different than the typical macro discussion we can have, where one can think of a state of the world that is probabilistically likely to happen. Well, in this case, it's very hard to predict much, guys. So I think the portfolio discussion that we had in the first part of the podcast is perhaps more informative for your audience than any, how can I say, Twitter-like, you know, flashy headline predicting what's going to happen next.
What are your thoughts?
I guess position sizing is also a way to think through that too, though. If you've got, you know, you position size it small, if things continue to blow up, you've got certain things in the portfolio that are going to respond positively to that those potentialities. And you also have the actual performance of the assets. If things start moving to downtrends, or if they get, you know, pretty heavy negative carry against them, all things that might inform your positioning and position sizing. So if you have an asymmetric upside on the trade, you can do a small trade. And if it works out to be, you know, you had to give that up because everything was restored to normal, there's a small loss, but you were hedged. And, you know, if it goes the wrong way, you've got something in your portfolio that has some asymmetric upside.
You can try to build that. Sure, that's possible. I think it was much easier to build payoff like that before the war started. Was much easier. Now convex is extremely trendy.
Of course.
But it's okay. But it's okay.
Yeah, we're buying insurance after our house is on fire.
Exactly.
Alfonso, before we wrap up, two questions. The first one is what is the most crowded trade in the world right now?
Right now, I would say the most crowded trade in the world.
What about short US dollar? I mean, that one seems to be pretty prevalent across the board, but I don't know how it's manifesting.
No, I think you're hitting close to home. There's been a lot of cleansing over the last few days. That's why I'm thinking about it. There's been a lot of cleansing.
Right.
People were very short dollar and they've been taken to the woodshed. And, you know, people were very long ex-US markets because it had become super popular to be long emerging markets and European banks and whatever. So those have all underperformed very aggressively. I would say structurally, from a portfolio construction perspective across the world, I would say probably At this point, I would still say that the U.S. tilt is very, very large. I mean, when you look at over a longer time horizon to what people own in pension funds and asset managers, there has been a small adjustments over the last 12 months towards the rest of the world. Structurally, the adjustment has been very, very small, very, very small. Now, of course, locally, the view of being long emerging markets, Europe, Japan, and Korea has been cleansed. So locally, I wouldn't have the same answer. But structurally, yes, the world is very long U.S. assets, very, very long U.S. assets.
Great. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's true.
That's your point on 65% of the global index being U.S. equities still.
Yeah.
Okay. And a year from now, what are we going to be most surprised about?
Pending other exogenous shock or endogenous shocks caused by Trump, I would say we will be very surprised about nominal growth in the rest of the world. Nominal growth outside the United States is going to surprise on the upside. That's mathematics driven by the large amount of money creation in these places. Germany is doing the largest fiscal impulse that we have seen for many, many decades. It's worth 1.75% of GDP. That's very large. And alongside with Germany, we're having Japan doing the same, Korea doing the same, Sweden doing the same, Australia doing the same. Even Canada has turned towards fiscal deficit. So the rest of the world, in terms of nominal growth, in my opinion, will surprise many people on the upside. Of course, if you raise the price of energy by 40, 50%, then what I'm saying is not valid anymore. But in principle, barring exogenous shocks, I would say it's my median expectation that the rest of the world growth, nominal growth, will surprise consensus to the upside.
That is awesome. I like Alfonso, that. I think that thinking through that as an advisor and an allocator is something to think through. As something to consider as you look at your allocations today.
Thank you.
Well, guys, always a pleasure to be here. Happy to jump on whenever there is any macro turbulence where I might add some value. In this case, Strait of Hormuz, I can add zero value. On that specifically, zero value. I hope that people found the discussion on the portfolio construction more interesting. I think that's anyway much more important for people to focus on and think thoroughly than it is to predict or to gamble on any shorter macro event, be it Hormuz or anything else. So thank you for having the podcast and especially focusing it around portfolio construction and savings portfolio construction, which I think is a topic that needs much more coverage in general. And you guys are doing a great job at that.
Absolutely. Alfonso, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you for your incredibly valuable time, your energy, and your insight.
Thank you very much, guys. Speak soon.
Thank you.